You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Richard Ellman, the author most recently of Tar Beach. And I began reading this book and discovered gradually that I thought it was a kind of Jewish Ulysses. How much was that kind of novel on your mind? It is a book of voices and sounds and smells and the scent of a city in 1947. But
yeah, I guess I thought to myself at some point in my life, why not, when I read Ulysses and when I read Call It Sleep, which is a Jewish Ulysses in a way, Henry Roth's great book. But when I read Ulysses, I thought to myself in some way, why not do with language in some way what he was doing in Ulysses? And we used to read it aloud to each other when I was growing up in Brooklyn, and because it was the only way we could really follow all of it was reading it aloud. So sure, I mean, it was deeply in. But I think, you know, the fact that Joyce was really using street sound, street language, the demotic was very, very powerful and very convincing. I had been to graduate school and all that, and I was supposed to write like Henry James, and I was appalled by the idea after a while because I couldn't do it. I was all elbows. My professor at Stanford said, "You have a Brooklyn ear," and I took that as a great insult at the time. But in fact, one day it occurred to me, he's right. I do have a Brooklyn ear, and what's so terrible about that? And James had an Albany ear, it was, I mean, you know, so.
As a reader and as a Jewish reader, it took me a while to train my ear in that way. I remember Donald Barthelme gave me a copy of Grace Paley's The Little Disturbances of Man.
That's a wonderful book.
A great book. And I was so haughty and so young that the minute I began the first story, which was about the Yiddish theater, I remember it was full of sentences like, "Your mama, she stands with a towel in her hand all day dusting. I can't read this." Yeah. You know, this is what I'm trying to escape from. And of course, any writer, you know, makes their way gradually back to the voice that comes from home.
And Grace is very tenderly sending up that thing at the same time that she's delighting in it. She's sort of sending it up to the other writer, I suppose, almost as important, in some ways more important than either of those two that I mentioned, I think would be Isaac Babel, particularly the Odessa stories, the Awakening, the story of My Dovecote, some of these stories which really have that power of being out of school.
Uh-huh. Well, you have a great tendency like Babel to write things in short, sharp fragments. And I also thought a bit, maybe you know him, maybe you don't, of Postofsky.
No, I love the Postofsky stuff on Babel, but that's all I know about Postofsky. You know, in his memoirs, he has these wonderful things about Babel, who he knew in Odessa. Yeah,
I love reading that stuff.
It's beautiful,
beautifully
stuff.
Written, and the special beauty of it is, you know, sentences set against each other rather than leading to one another.
Yeah, he talks about Babel, talking about how he wrote, and Babel said, "How, you know how hard it is to make one of these stories?" And he tells him all the drafts. He's got them like that.
So I'm talking about Tar Beach, though, published by Sun and Moon Press. And this is part of their New American Fiction series, which won an award from Publishers Weekly some years ago as being the best new project in American publishing. How did Tar Beach come to Sun and Moon?
It came to Sun and Moon pretty much in the following way. I got tired of getting really very dumb letters from trade publishers, and I'd sort of withdrawn it. And I gave a reading at a place in New York, which is a very lively, hip place called the Ear Inn down on the...
Sure.
Way downtown. Among the people who were there was a playwright named Mack Wellman, who was I knew him a little bit, but I didn't know him well, and he loved the reading. I read the first chapter, which was with all the Swedish and the Yiddish and the Swahili, and he just thought it was funny and charming. And he said, "You know, if you want, I'd be very happy. I know Douglas Messily would read it and be interested in it if you want to send it to them." So I thought about that, and I got my then agent to, like, twisting his arm. I had to go because he really wasn't anything in it for him to do this. And finally said, you know, this was, I can't even remember the name of the company. They were big literary agents. I don't have an agent like that at the moment, but I mean, anyway. And he very nicely finally sent it to Douglas and said that Mack Wellman said he should take a look at it. And I think some time elapsed, quite a lot of time elapsed. And then one day I got the best letter I ever got from an editor, from Doug Messily, who had not only read the book but really given it some thought and wasn't afraid of it. And he actually made some rather good suggestions because I was still working on the manuscript. I always said I was sending it out because I wanted a commitment, but I knew I had to do more work on the manuscript. I was aware of that. And so he said, you know, finish it and we would be interested.
Well, I'm very proud of Sun and Moon for having published it for the following reason, that while it does partake somewhat of the modernist tradition and while Sun and Moon is an avant-garde press, this is, you know, an ethnic novel. Mm-hmm. And you don't expect to see it necessarily amongst the modernities of Sun and Moon, of which I'm very fond. And so when I started the book, I was expecting, you know, something that would, you know, fly in many different kinds of linguistic orbit. But this book is a book that's full of Yiddish and Swahili, and I thought it would be helpful for readers to know how Uganda comes into this novel that is set on the roof of a synagogue in Brooklyn where people sun themselves and bathe. It's sort of a, you know, a club, I guess.
It's a health club above it. It was actually, the synagogue was never built in this building. They built the health club before they built the synagogue. They eventually built on the ground floor kind of sanctuary. But anyway, it had a gymnasium and a swimming pool and handball courts. It was really quite a pleasant place. But on the roof, they had a solarium, and the men and women sunbathed naked separately, or you didn't have to be naked, but most chose to be. And there was a partition in the middle. And how it got to be, it was always very, very hot up there. And, I mean, really hot. I mean, and I was, I knew this place as a kid. An actual place like this as a kid. Not quite the same place, but sort of like it. I was remember reading something, and something I read which really struck me, which said that in 1904 or 1905, I don't remember the exact year at this point, I have it down in the book, in the epigraph, the colonial secretary, the British colonial secretary, offered the Zionist delegation Uganda. He said, in fact, you know, we can't give you Palestine. It would be a little complicated. There are a lot of Arabs there, and there's also a lot of oil there, and so on. We're not going to do that. No. But we have this piece of real estate down in southern Africa. Would you like Uganda as a Jewish national homeland? And, of course, Herzl, as I recall, Chaim Weizmann and some of the people turned it down right away, but others were interested in Uganda and a colonizing movement in Uganda. And I thought, Jesus, the chutzpah, the British imperialists doing this, first of all. These people, there are only, you know, maybe 5 or 6 million people living there, and two cultures at least, maybe more there. What if indeed it had been Uganda rather than Palestine? So I was thinking, well, what about a fantasy of somebody who sort of is living? And now, where would that be? And I thought of this solarium and this roof and my own experience and how I always felt that everybody was changing color up there in some way. It was they would spend the whole summer there, and they would finally get
schwitzing,
and they put the stuff on themselves, all different kinds of things, you know. And I mentioned some of the things in the book, olive oil and gentian violet and olive oil and prune juice and
Noxima
other things. Stuff, you know, to change. And they would literally change. So you had the feeling of a kind of tribal culture, a different culture, a primitive, funky kind of world that was different than the world of these very somewhat uptight in their clothing Ashkenazi Jews who ordinarily inhabited this synagogue. When I was doing the last draft, after I knew the book, I decided to go back and see this place again. And I walked in on a Sunday morning because I figured, well, first of all, it's hard for me to get to that part. I live way out from the city. I came in on a Sunday morning, and it was in the early summer. I just wanted to see the place again and try and check it out with my memories of it. And I saw a bunch of old men eating lox and bagels, and they was some of the men. I looked at them again. First, I didn't recognize them. And I realized why I didn't recognize them, because they were all wearing sport jackets and silk shirts and so on. I'd never seen any of them with their clothes on. The only way I remembered them was all naked. And I had to think what this guy must have looked like 35 years ago when I remember him with lying around naked, you know. And then I remembered him, yeah. And so, you know, there were about 10 of these people who when I actually sat down and wrote the book, I took this from there and that from that, and mostly just invented it because it was so richer. You know, you invent your memories.
Well, the book is narrated, it's set in 1947, and it's more or less, although there are shifting points of view, its hero more or less is the young boy who's been sent home for homicidal behavior from his summer camp, where inevitably he will go every day to sit up on this roof with his father, with occasional excursions into the women's section, a door which says, "Do not enter women." and occasionally the gift of an orange or a banana. And a boy who's, you know, wandering around, hearing about big business, about politics, about sex, about nakedness, and ultimately about family and other kinds of love. You were mentioning before we started that this is a novel for you that's about certain demarcations of love.
Well, I think, yeah. I think I wrote the book because I was aware at some point in my life that there were people who were very important to me as a young person in my life who weren't my family. And indeed, my family was a rather dysfunctional family. I'd written about that a lot. I wrote an autobiography called Freddie and Cheryl and the Kids, which is almost a direct kind of send-up of family. I wouldn't want to write that. I was really writing about, I survived all that, and I, for better or worse, I mean, I'm still around, and I do my thing. And I want to write about these strangers who love you and sort of validate certain things in you. So and what you learn about love by watching people. I mean, a lot of my childhood and a lot of, to a degree, the childhood of this kid, and I think other childhood, was sort of looking at human nature and human behavior and saying, well, gee, that's different than what I see at home. Maybe that's the way it is, and then trying it out. I don't know whether I'm making myself clear, but, you know, oh, is that what love is?
Well, you know, it's from, yeah, there is, you know, in this world, a world full of uncles, and maybe they really had an affair with your mother, but maybe they didn't, and maybe they just like to think so, or maybe they would like to someday. And the boy is full of his speculations about where he comes from, and, you know, the father who, his father, Little Sam, is always intimidated by Big Sam, what we used to call in our neighborhood a balabusta, you know, who wheels and deals, and one day the boy has his fantasy confrontation with his father's ex-boss, telling him what a horrible man he is. And so I guess it is that, you know, tribal extended family all in the mind of the boy who practices a kind of demotic Ugandan?
Yeah. There's a character, a man who loves this boy, for, among other reasons, because he thinks he's his son. And they have a secret language, and they have a secret way, which is this language which they call Swiddish, which is a combination of Swahili and Yiddish. And as he points out, I got the Swahili from the old Paul Robeson records. And some of the people on this roof are from the left movement at the time, and some of them are real right-wingers, and there is a debate going on. It's 1947, before the creation of the State of Israel, and some of them are socialists, and some of them are Yabotinskyites, that is to say revisionists, and there's a fight going on about that, and there are some people who don't think that. It's interesting. I think it's important. I remember as a kid, you know, everybody thinks that most of the American Jewish population was always Zionist. In fact, I remember as a kid being in synagogues where the rabbis excoriated Zionists because they were going to get us all into trouble, you know. I mean, we're American citizens. We shouldn't have anything to do with all that stuff. And on the other hand, you know, they were very conservative. We want to be 100% American. We don't want to be in, you know, dual allegiance. So that's going on, too, at the same time. And all these men, or many of them, have just come home from this war in Europe. And they've lost time, you know. They kind of beat up some of them. The war really was rough on them. It was scary, and it was, and they lost time. And the country is getting greedier and greedier, and they're trying to catch up. And they're pretty greedy, too. So that's what this kid is experiencing. He's hearing it mostly because nobody will pay attention to him. I mean, he's just sort of cast off there. It's sort of his punishment to lie about. So
it's sort of funny, you know, when I was reading the book, I thought a little bit of this writer. Maybe no one knows him. And not even sure I ever really liked him, although what he was doing was amusing to me, named Jerome Sharon, who always used to write different versions of a kind of tribal ethnic New York. There was one book called Eisenhower, My Eisenhower. And I believe he now writes what appear as detective stories, but are still actually these sort of experimental novels about New York, in which mythical tribes of gypsies combat mythical tribes of policemen, and there's always rabbis wandering around dispensing knowledge. I wondered, you know, in the stylistics of this book, you stay so close to the roof, but in the final chapter, You zoom away, and we get what happens as the boy comes home to visit for a funeral from his first year of college. Why did you go outside?
That time. I guess I felt it was important to say, after I dramatized that, most of the book is one day with people thinking back over earlier times, but mostly it's one day. It is one day. But I wanted to say that in some way people
Survive
and grow and change and are transformed in some way. I'm always concerned with how did I manage to get through some of the stuff I did and other people I've seen. So I wanted to somehow say that. And so I thought by this big leap, and I wanted to see Izzy again. Izzy is this character who, I guess it's pretty clear that he's my favorite character in the book, and I have great feeling for him. And I knew a lot of Izzy's in my day, and they had their faults, but there was a certain warmth there.
I know, they're such funny people. He takes the young boy, Izzy does, Peter, in his arms and says that he'll be a poet like Essanin. But I remember one such, this was a woman, not a man, holding me and says, "You know, I'm stupid," she said to me. "I'm not very smart, but I love you, and someday you're going to find a cure for cancer."
That's right. Yeah.
There's always someone who has high hopes for you.
Yeah. And maybe the reverse is that other people don't, and this one does. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, because this is a boy whose father is really scapegoats him a lot, with some reason, at least some emotional reason, resents him is the word. Yeah, so I loved Izzy, and I wanted to see what would happen to Izzy, and I wanted to say that in some way Izzy ran out on, I don't want to give away the story too much, but Izzy sort of ran out on his life. He didn't have the strength to lead his life. Mm-hmm. And that's why I did it that way. I wanted to somehow suggest also that this is all gone. Gone, you know that line of Edward Thomas, gone, gone again, gone, you know, that it's all disappeared, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of your epigraphs has Kafka addressing a group of members of the Jewish community of Prague, saying, "You know more Yiddish than you think you know." Now, as I picked up this book, I discovered that I know more Yiddish than I think I know. But were you concerned about the disappearance of sense in the welter of Yiddish and Brooklynisms and Swahili? I didn't have much trouble myself, but I have that background, which I share with you.
I worked very hard on trying to clear it up. I mean, that's one of the big rewrite jobs. How much could I need? How much should I leave in? How much should I take out? But then again, I wanted also the fact that I lived in that world, And I didn't understand every word that was said, but I did somehow get the thrust of everything, and I didn't really mind. You know, the Kafka quote is very interesting because, of course, the Prague Jewish community all spoke German. That's why he said that to him. And I assume a lot of people speak German. I know a lot of my Gentile friends have read the book, and they know it because it's very close to German. And he says, I guarantee you know more Yiddish than you think you know. Kafka was another early enthusiasm of mine, but I don't have his mind for abstraction. I'm not that kind of writer. I like to be very physical and very, very funky in a certain way. But, yeah, I guess I was concerned about it. It bothered some publishers. One very distinguished literary publisher said he would never publish a book like this, David Godin, because he said, you know, you write very well, but there are no Jewish people like this, and even if there were, I wouldn't want to read about them.
It reminds me of Cynthia Ozick's story, Yiddish in America, that whole question of will a language die, and if it does, will it have a literature?
Yeah. Well, Cynthia and I are about poles apart on everything, but I guess one time we were friends, a long, long time ago, we've fallen out about everything I can think of, but yeah. Yeah, I was, I guess some of my interest in that, not only coming from that background, but at one time in the 60s when I was first starting out as a writer, I befriended Basheva Singer, who was also really just restarting out on his career. He had a very distinguished career in Warsaw and so on, but he really, and in Yiddish, but in English, he didn't have much of a career yet. And I used to go to his house every Sunday night with another friend of mine, and we'd talk, and we'd help translate some of his stories, or he'd read us translation. We'd tell him if it sounded like English and so on. So I used to know him, and he'd serve us tea. And we'd spend, you know, many Sundays for a couple of years did that. And I did a very famous interview with him, which appeared all over the place. As I say, at that time, he was hardly known to people. But so that was a big thing in my life.
Interesting. You know, it's funny. He once came to visit Buffalo when I was a student there. And I introduced him to Leslie Fiedler and to the new wife of Leslie Fiedler at that time. And I said, do you know, this new wife of Leslie's used to be a nun. True. And he looked with such narrowed and delighted eyes. Yes, he would get very excited.
He had correspondence with a Yiddish nun who had converted to Catholicism named Sister Muriel, and he used to read us the correspondence, pieces of the correspondence occasionally.
He was astonishing. Even in that brief, I introduced him to Dwight MacDonald, who was teaching there at the time, and he said to Dwight, I'm an admirer of your many humanistical essays. And Dwight thanked him and said that he admired Isaac's stories. Especially, he felt he had the qualities of Edgar Allan Poe, both able to be weird and ratiocinative. And do you know, MacDonald said, The Raven. He's thinking and thinking, you know, the singer is looking very puzzled. Maybe The Crow. No, not The Crow. Dwight was very splenetic. The Raven. So maybe in Poland we didn't have ravens, we had a crow. it was very wonderful always to hear him because he would settle disputes in such a, you know, whimsical way.
When I found out, when we had talked to him, we had read Gipple the Fool, and we loved it. Just bowled us over, so we went to see him on the basis of that. But when we got to know, we found out he had a career even in Warsaw. He'd been a literary translator in Warsaw and had translated a whole lot of books, including he translated The Magic Mountain into Yiddish. So when we found this out, I said to him, you know, well, what did you do with the chapter in French in The Magic Mountain? Because French can't be transliterated into Yiddish. He said, well, he said it was very easy. They told me it was bad French. So he said, I made it into bad Yiddish. God knows it's easy enough to write bad Yiddish. I mean,
that's marvelous.
It took a while to sort of dispel him from my, you know, you move through things when you're a young person and you try and find your own voice. I didn't want to write his stories. I wanted to write my stories. And our lives were very different and what we thought about. But so I had to, it took a long time to get him out of the way, because he was so, he was the best raconteur I'd ever met. He could tell stories that were just, have you in stitches, and sex, he knew, the erotic.
Every trick in the book.
in both meanings of the word, yeah. Yeah,
it was. Did he ever see any of this manuscript?
No.
Tom Beach?
He never. The one thing about Singer, and I think I can say this without saying I'm putting down a dead man, because he not only didn't read anything that I ever gave him, and I used to give him books when they did start coming out, but I don't think he read anybody's work, that I know of. He told me, I would say, did you ever read, because Bello translated Gimple the Fool, did you read? No. He said, the first time I met him, he said, we admired Gimple the Fool, which was translated. He said, tell me, he says, is this Saul Bellow, is he a good writer? this was when Jean-Paul Sartre won the Nobel Prize, we were seeing him that Sunday night. He said, this Sartre, he's not a good writer, is he? So he said, well, he's a different kind of writer than you.
This is exactly what happened. Terry Gross, who does the Fresh Air show on NPR, we drove him to the airport together. We found him in the small library in the student union. He had Nabokov's Ada. He said he usually liked Nabokov, but not this. The other book by his side was Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow. And I said, what do you think of this? He said, he's not my writer.
but that's profoundly true and real. But but he never read Malamud, he claimed. He never read Roth. And now some of this was being very foxy and very canny, but some of it was true. I don't think he had some people who he would read. Knut Hamsun, he read,
yes,
and loved and adored, and he loved that kind of streak of eroticism that and Hamsun. He read Dostoevsky, although he used to deny it. He translated The Possessed into Yiddish, and he knew Dostoevsky backwards and forwards, as does Nabokov, who says he hates him. One of the reasons why he says he hates him is because there are remarkable similarities at times between them, except that Nabokov's funnier. although Dostoevsky's pretty funny, too, at times, in Brothers K, yeah. But, so Singer knew some of that stuff, and he knew it from a long time ago, and he read, he loved letters and correspondence. One of the reasons why I think he stayed at the Forwards, because he got a lot of material from there, and he would read the Advice to the Lovelorn stuff and letters that came into him there, and people, his fan mail, he loved. He read the Daily News. He used to tell me he used to like to read crime stories, and he read about the occult, and he would read the occult. William James's psychic research stuff, mm-hmm, he loved. He loved any kind of stuff where somebody's had an out-of-body experience, or met a ghost or a spook or whatever. And I said, well, did you ever? He said, no. He said, but it's still interesting, you know?
I've been talking to Richard Ellman, whose novel Tar Beach, published by Sun and Moon Press, is about tribal life up on the sweltering roof of a synagogue health club, very much like the supermarket bowling alley that's mentioned in the book. And it's a great pleasure to have had you here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. It was a lovely time.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. The land of ice is flowing books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's books. The mouse, mouse.